The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 273, Writing from Within a Religion, with a Jewish perspective by Robert A. Goldberg and a Mormon perspective by Dean May.
It's a pleasure to be here, and it's always a pleasure to be on a panel with my colleague, Bob Goldberg, who really works hard at keeping me in line and does a pretty good job of it. I think it might be helpful at the outset for me to sketch very briefly my placement within the Latter-day Saint community. I was once a bishop. I'm presently a member of a stake high council. And I think much more importantly, I'm a believing and practicing member of the faith. And that for three reasons. First, because of personal spiritual affirmations I've received. Second, because of my conviction that the world would be a better place if more lived under the type of communal and personal regimen that the church asks of its members. And third, because some of my ancestors have been intimately involved in the church almost since its founding. And this latter point is not at all trivial. The Catholic sociologist Thomas O'Day, in a phrase that has been almost quoted almost as often as the famous couplet about as man is, God once was, said that the clearest example in our national history of a native and an indigenously developed ethnic minority is the Mormons. And certainly I, along with many of you in this room, could recite many hours of tales tying my family and therefore myself into a web of experience that extends back a century and a half and is full of themes of privation and persecution and sacrifice, and from which the major strands of my identity and sense of separateness from American society are derived. And help comes just in the nick of time. Thanks, Jen.
Doesn't matter. Which do you prefer?
Okay, thanks. Okay. Since I'm talking about writing from within, I'll take the decaffeinated. In a word, then, part of the reason I am a Mormon is because I was born a Mormon. It's possible to change such a core identity, but you have to want to, and it isn't easy. And so, with that preface, I proceed on the first task one faces when explaining the problems and prospects of writing from within a particular tradition, which is to explain what it is about that tradition that impinges upon the task. So while I hope to avoid our panel becoming a contest between competing claims as to which community poses the most difficult challenges for those working within it, I have to say that engaging in historical inquiry within my tradition is at best complicated. While others deal with similar cross-cutting elements of religious belief and ethnic identity, it isn't common for a religion to have been the foundation and the conscious instigator, if you will, of the ethnicity, and that very recently. Scholarly analysis of ethnic traits of the Latter-day Saints at times raises issues that reflect upon religious claims and faith. And these issues, in turn, engender hot and impassioned responses, both from those whose intent it is to deny the legitimacy of Mormon religious claims and from those whose intent it is to affirm them. The fact that Mormonism is only 167 years old complicates matters still further, as the canon unique to Mormonism was produced so recently that anything akin to textual criticism inevitably turns to questions of validity in a way that much older traditions have outgrown. One can easily examine issues raised in biblical text without necessarily addressing the question of whether there really was a Joshua, a Ruth, or a Psalm of King David's authorship. But in Mormonism, the message is still intimately tied to the validity of its claimed origins. All of this is further complicated by the fact that the Utah-based branch of the Mormon tradition is strongly hierarchical and led by men that, for historical reasons I'll explain, are particularly sensitive about the legitimacy of their claim to religious authority, and because of age and lineage, are still tilting in some measure against 19th and early 20th century windmills. Several recent Mormon prophets have been grandsons of men and women who participated in the founding of Mormonism, thus bringing to their leadership personal and familial agendas that go back to that time. It may be helpful to remind you that the early Latter-day Saint movement began as I see it, with a clear purpose: to build an enclave of order, a refuge from the increasingly diverse and individualistic world that modern liberalism had spawned. Joseph Smith's most mature and complete account of the epiphany that propelled him on his religious mission expressed clearly the pain he felt at seeing no small stir and division, the great confusion and bad feeling, and strife of words and contest of opinions in his society, and indeed even within his own family. The injunction to harmony, unity, and order became central to his message and had great appeal both to Americans tormented by the excesses of democracy and to English men and women dislocated by industrialization. Joseph Smith's instrument for building unity and order was his claim to speak authoritatively for God. The Mormon prophet experienced challenges to his authority from within his flock almost from the time of its founding. He responded to these challenges with an 1830 revelation in which stern instructions were given that no one shall be appointed to receive commandments or revelations in this church excepting my servant Joseph Smith, Jr., for he receiveth them even as Moses. I have given him the keys of the mysteries and the revelations which are sealed until I shall appoint unto them another in his stead. The principle thus defined was a major asset to Joseph Smith and to subsequent prophets of Latter-day Saint churches in countering claims to their ultimate authority and maintaining a rather remarkable core of order and harmony among the saints, given the enormous inherent potential for fragmentation in a new faith that, despite the 1830 revelation, continues to this day to encourage and affirm the validity of personal revelation. That notwithstanding, the first great crisis in the church's history centered upon the question of authority, particularly who had the authority to succeed to leadership after the death of Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram in June 1844. Smith had left contradictory indications as to how his successor should be named, at times indicating lineal descent through his male heirs, at times suggesting the apostles would choose a successor. His death precipitated a contest over who was chief among several brilliant and charismatic potential leaders. Much of Brigham Young's energy between 1844 and 1847 was devoted to disarming the various claimants to authority and fortifying his own as senior apostle. The exigencies of the exodus to the far west, which Young led, and the effort to maintain ecclesiastical, civic, and social order in such a setting led his followers to affirm strongly the ultimate power and authority of the 12 apostles, the first presidency, and by extension that of other high church officials whom they very significantly call general authorities. A useful contrast is provided in comparing the experience of the Utah Latter-day Saints with those that stayed in the Midwest. A good many rejected Brigham Young's leadership, eventually persuading Joseph Smith's son to accept the role of prophet in what they call the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In this instance, the church was formed first, and its members then called the prophet to lead them. Thus, the historical experience of these prairie saints, as they've been called sometimes, led to a more decentralized polity in which the body of saints assembled in conference have considerable power. That of the Rocky Mountain saints led to a more enhanced central authority. The mountain states elevated those portions of Joseph Smith's 1830 revelation that stressed the paramount authority of the prophet to receive revelation for the church. To them, the idea of vetoing a prophetic revelation, which the prairie saints have at times come close to doing, would be tantamount to vetoing God himself or herself. It is against this background that the problems of writing from within the Latter-day Saint tradition have to be understood. The stress upon harmony, unity, and order, the production of the sacred texts in recent historical times, the tendency of authority and power to be centralized rather than dispersed, the protracted struggle to claim the mantle of Joseph Smith, and the mixture of ethnic and religious identities all tend to make present Latter-day Saint members and leaders unusually sensitive to particular kinds of scholarly inquiry. When such inquiry threatens harmony or reflects upon the integrity or authority of church leaders, Latter-day Saints will usually close ranks and discipline or exclude the offenders. This is essentially what has happened in the last few years, as several particular general authorities have reacted to what they perceive as slurs upon their integrity or that of their predecessors, which question their authority and, in their view, disturb the harmony of the body of believers. Though I consider myself a social historian of the American West more than a historian of Mormonism, I've included the study of Mormon society among my interests, And despite these peculiarities I've referred to, I labor, of course, under the challenge common to us all of trying to lift my perspective out of my own community in order to try to see it clearly and as others might see it. One problem that vexes those who write from within is insularity. My most recent study was a comparison of values among American rural people who settled in the Willamette Valley and the Boise Valley and the Mormon settlers of the Utah Valley. The study has tended, once underway, to shape itself in ways I had not anticipated. But I began it with the thought that the culture of Mormon rural people has been misunderstood, or at least ill understood, through a failure to place it within the context of all the peoples who settled in the far west in the 19th century. In other words, the entire study has been, in part, an effort to broaden my perspective beyond that of my own community. And I feel that the effort did indeed help me in some measure to accomplish that. My insights into the Mormon society were enormously enhanced by my efforts to understand and write on other traditions, which I, perforce, had to do from without. And I think our understanding of other traditions is enhanced as well, as the comparisons with each other and with different modes of social organization within the Mormon society exhibit. My experience in this project suggests that while it's impossible fully to displace one's own cultural and intellectual footing in looking at others, through much labor and empathy, a good deal more distance can be accomplished in such an exercise than many are willing to concede. The first three points of advice I give to Mormon graduate students writing on Mormon history are to broaden, broaden, broaden. Take the pains, do the reading, seek the empathy needed to maximize the hope of seeing the group you are studying from a broader perspective, even if it's your own group, or especially if it's your own group. And though we who write from within a tradition may find it difficult to see with other eyes, we have the advantage of possessing an intimate, almost intuitive understanding of at least some aspects of the group we study. A good many non-Mormons have written about the Mormon past or commented on Mormon society. Of these, I could easily count on one hand the number who have been able to enter the world of Mormonism sufficiently to write persuasively about it. One of them is with us here today. More commonly, scholars writing from within, without impose meanings from their own world upon words or symbolic acts of Mormons that look and walk and talk like ducks, but in the Mormon world are seen as doves. Feminists, for example, see a male-headed church hierarchy and impose the word patriarchy with all that implies in the non-Mormon world and with the deep history that that has in the non-Mormon world. They fail utterly, I would suggest, however, to understand or to communicate to their readers that this patriarchy operates under a different set of rules and towards different ends than the patriarchies which they imagine Mormon men to be of a peace with. Again, I don't argue that the outside observer can never get within, but I do believe, as with getting out, the investment needed to accomplish it is considerable, and few are really willing to make it. They all too frequently appear to Mormon scholars to be floundering as hopelessly as the FBI agent from Washington in a Tony Hillerman novel trying to track down a murderer in Navajo country. My first three points of advice, then, to non-Mormons attempting to understand the Mormon past are to deepen, deepen, deepen. But these problems are common to researchers writing from within almost any well-defined group, and the strategies I propose are obvious and, at least in a general sense, common to all of us. More difficult are the questions implied in my long wind-up. How does writing from within a tradition affect one's own relationship to that community? The most dramatic possibility within my tradition is that such scholarship may lead to formal exclusion through church discipline. Does honest scholarship necessarily, as one of my recently excommunicated friends and colleagues maintains, jeopardize one's standing within the tradition? The answer, obviously, is that it depends upon what one chooses to study within it. The hazards are greater in the Mormon tradition for reasons I've just outlined. But even there, much depends upon what one studies and how one chooses to present one's findings. Hundreds of Mormon scholars who study aspects of Mormonism from the perspectives of many different disciplines have reported their research honestly and openly in academic journals and elsewhere without any response from church leaders or members. For almost 20 years, I've published my research, actually for a little more than 20 years, I've published my research on Mormonism and not flinching from many issues that the Mormon hierarchy is uncomfortable with. In a highly public medium, a 20-part video series on Utah history, I address such topics as the Mountain Meadows Massacre, the failure of Mormon economic and communal endeavor, the narrowness of some past church leaders, the possible influences of temple ceremonies on the society, and a good many other topics, discomforting, I suspect, to true believers. In all that time, no church leader at any level has spoken to me, questioned me, or attempted to counter, as far as I know, what I've presented. Though my turn may come tomorrow, I, for the moment, suspect my relative immunity from censorship has come from several aspects of my scholarship, which arise not so much from any conscious strategy on my part as out of my own temperament and scholarly interests. As a scholar, I begin with the assumption that spiritual experiences are as real for Mormons as they are for Muslims, Hindus, Catholics, and Protestants and Jews. I cannot presume to write upon the reality of such transcendent experiences, whether they actually happen. They are, by their personal nature, quite beyond the world of scholarly inquiry. More importantly, their reality isn't very interesting to me as a scholar. Far more interesting is the question framed something like this: given that people believe this or that happened, what are the consequences of such belief? In other words, it isn't so important that beliefs are or are not based upon some demonstrable real event, but rather that these beliefs change human beings and human societies. Of course, these are traditional concerns of social and cultural historians and anthropologists and sociologists. We rarely find it necessary to deal with questions of reality of forces that shape human belief and behavior, but rather with the consequences of beliefs and behaviors, whatever their ultimate origin. I may also have been protected from official opprobrium by the fact that I'm a fairly shy person who doesn't seek attention and am content to lecture in obscure classrooms and professional meetings such as this to small audiences, and to publish for the most part in equally obscure places. I've been protected thus far from official church disapproval of my work by the almost coincidental fact that my own scholarly interests do not require me to address questions that may reflect on the authority or integrity of church leaders, nor do they threaten the harmony of present-day Mormon society, partly because I do not seek to place my work in the headlines. There has been one possible exception, a book I did with Leonard J. Arrington and Fairmore's Young Fox on Mormon communalism. The book was published in 1976 by Deseret Book Company, an LDS-owned publisher, as I'm sure you all know, some 10,000 copies of it, which quickly sold out. The book, shortly after the printing, was placed upon a list of books that cannot be cited in church publications, and for 16 years, Deseret Book Company retained the copyright and refused to print a second edition or to sell the copyright. In 1992, I'm not quite that old, they permitted the University of Illinois Press to print a paperback edition. In all of this time, all of those 16 years, no one from the church ever spoke to Leonard Arrington or myself about the book or offered reasons for not reprinting it. Perhaps their handling of the matter was based purely upon judgments about the economic viability of a second edition, fearing they had saturated the market with the first, but I doubt it. But there may be an aspect of the problem more important than the few occasions when church leaders, formally or informally, have questioned the work of scholars writing from within or have disciplined such scholars. Far more commonly, the researchers themselves, through the very act of scholarly understanding of their tradition, find themselves estranged from that tradition, or at least find its power in their lives diminished. Commonly, scholarly study of one's own culture diminishes a perceived sense of uniqueness that often is a component of solidarity and identity within the culture. It likewise diminishes the power of symbols and symbolic acts as one learns that their origins are identifiable in time and place, sometimes profane in origin, and that such symbols and acts have over time been mutable. Stories of heroism and sacrifice often lose their power when one learns that human frailty was intermixed with the more heroic qualities. And oftentimes, the mere contacts and process of working outside one's culture tend to draw one away at times, evoking shame or embarrassment for being from such a peculiar community and tempting one to show the world that they are as with it and mainstream as anybody else, with sometimes comic and sometimes tragic consequences. The diminishing of solidarity within one's community or with one's community is by no means inevitable or a universal consequence of doing scholarly work from within, but it is a common one. Indeed, many of the Mormons I know who have been subject to formal action had, in fact, long since distanced or removed themselves from the church, the formal action only acknowledging a long-existing altering of their relationship to the church through their own initiative. The fact that many of them resent and resist church discipline, in spite of no longer being believers, arises, I suspect, from the fact that they wish to retain a sense of ethnic belonging with the Latter-day Saints, which they understand correctly is still rather more closely tied to the church membership than in many other traditions. I would conclude, therefore, by suggesting that formal action to expel scholars writing from within a group is really fairly uncommon and rare, and in the long run, not nearly as consequential as the impact upon many, many scholars of the more subtle process of estrangement that often leads one eventually to feel distanced and alien both to their own culture and to that of others in the society. Perhaps those embarking on an academic examination of their own community or tradition should be required to read a warning label: beware, scholarly study of a community from within may be hazardous to your identity. But somehow I have escaped that aspect of estrangement from scholarly work as well, I think for four reasons, and I'll summarize them very briefly. I've learned to live, this is probably a moral defect on my part, with a certain tolerance for dissonance. I don't expect perfection, nor do I expect perfect consistency. I seem to have this, again, a moral failing, ability to bracket problems that would make no sense to me, that simply I don't understand, concluding that despite these problems, there's so much that sustains and supports me and that I value in my community that it would be foolish to leave it because of the little bit that I don't understand or that I'm not comfortable with. Secondly, the discipline of being an historian has taught me to be tolerant of human frailty and to understand that this too, perhaps even post-structuralism, will pass. Or that my own growth and my own understanding of a matter and my own perspective may change, and what was once a problem for me may ultimately not be a problem. And finally, I have to admit I find folly and moral and ethical shortness in every human institution and in every human community, believe it or not, even in academe. But I also find greatness of spirit in most human communities and in academe as well. Why should I turn from the community that nourished me to embrace another that has frailties and problems of its own? And finally, a kind of ineffable fact that we in the academy are often driven by demons that compel us to study our own people. And often the rewards are rich and affirming to ourselves and to our mother societies, while hopefully opening stimulating and instructive insights to our colleagues on the outside. Thanks very much.
This session poses two key questions. First, what are the pitfalls of writing from within one's own tradition, one's own religious tradition? And second, what are the advantages? In thinking about the Jewish tradition, my mind conjured up and fixed upon a quote. My mind fixed and conjured upon a quote from Sheriff Wyatt Earp, an upholder of law and order in Dodge City, Kansas, and later in Tombstone, Arizona. "The law," quipped Earp, "is a funny thing." Similarly, being Jewish and following a Jewish tradition is a funny thing. Jews have no hierarchical structure. We don't really belong to an organized religion. individual congregations affiliate with different movements: the Reform movement, the Conservative movement, the Orthodox movement, and the Reconstructionists. Ties are loose, non-binding. Each congregation is a body, a community, unto itself. The rabbi's authority in each congregation is an authority, a power to persuade. When our local rabbi in Salt Lake was asked by a member of the First Presidency, "How far does your authority extend?" our rabbi responded, "Never beyond the kitchen of my own home." And usually, not even that. Other than monotheism, and I think you should asterisk that in your mind, other than monotheism, there is no binding doctrine, no binding catechism that unites Jews. The individual is in communion with God as he or she perceives he or she. There is no excommunication of dissenters, of agnostics, of atheists for at least 3 or 4 centuries. Moreover, there is a spectrum of answers to the question, who is a Jew? A fierce debate rages not only in Israel, but in this country. Questions about your mother's religion, the ritual practice, the conversion practice, all suggest answers to that very complex question. And that complex question leads us even to a larger, more profound issue, and that is, for many Jews in Israel and here, Jewishness is more than a religion. It is a beyond religion. It is an ethnicity, a cultural, historical, and ethical identity. Judaism, then, is more than the synagogue. It is an identity, a rootedness, a commitment to ethical beliefs, to ethical codes, a responsibility to use the Hebrew tikkun olam, to repair the world, to pursue goodly behavior, to leave the world a better place, to help the weak, to support the poor. Done not out of a sense of heavenly reward or out of hellish punishment. This is, in my mind, a Judaism that means a call beyond the self, a call to activism, not only for Jews, but for all of mankind and womankind. With that as a prologue, I'd like to shift gears and move the focus from the session's questions. I'd like to ask different ones that still, in my mind, get to the core of the session's purpose. The questions I'd like to ask this afternoon are, how has my Jewish identity affected my sense of history? How have my experiences, my research, in turn, echoed and fed back to shape my identity? In order to answer those questions, I ask that you go with me on a historical quest, a historical quest that is, for me, intensely personal. But I believe this quest is important, is valuable, because it reveals the interplay of the historian, the religious tradition or traditions, and the pursuit of history. Nearly half a century ago, I was born in New York City. New York City, as you all know, has a critical mass of Jews, which means it is easy to be Jewish in New York City. Public schools are closed for religious holidays, Jewish religious holidays, in New York City. Organizations exist in New York to foster the full range of Jewish belief and Jewish ideas. There is a multiplicity of synagogues, of cultural events, and, of course, multiple outlets for Jewish food. You don't have to worry about being Jewish in New York. That perhaps explains the minimum of Jewish education I received in New York. I received the rudiments for bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah refers to a coming of age for boys and girls, the age of 13, when the child assumes the responsibilities of adulthood in the religion. But the idea was Jewishness would take care of itself. But the unexpected happened. At age 15, my family left New York City and moved to Arizona, moved to a suburb of Phoenix called Scottsdale. At that time, in the mid-1960s, there was but one synagogue in the entire Phoenix area. I was the only Jew in my high school, And in Phoenix at the time, hotels, restaurants were restricted. Jews were not permitted to enter, to eat, to reside in certain places. The Phoenix Country Club, the leading country club at the time, had just begun to end its ban on Jewish membership. And the Camelback Inn and other resorts were still closed to Jews. At college at Arizona State University, I found little relief. There were few Jews, and there was no student organization that catered to Jews. What was once familiar, what was once taken for granted, was now gone. And care packages from the East were poor substitutes to foster and nurture a sense of Jewishness. This isolation, this distinctiveness, forced me to understand myself as a Jew. It led me to nurture, to cultivate my Jewish identity. And I did that first in a hobby, then in a major, and then in a profession, which was American history. American history became my lever, became my means to rootedness and to community building. The subjects I research, the subjects I write about, are intensely personal and related to my life. In exploring these topics, I begin to know myself as a person and as a Jew. And I'd like to take you through a tour of the topics that I've researched over my career and give you a sense of the interaction, again, of my identity, history, and the Jewish tradition. My first topic was about an organization called the Ku Klux Klan. Many people have heard the words, and when they hear the words Ku Klux Klan, their minds conjure up an image of Southern roughnecks, Southern rednecks, out to intimidate, harass blacks, riding at night in their fiendish pursuits. The 1960s were a formative period of time for me growing up, and the Klan rode, as many of you know, in the 1960s. And this was a very personal experience because my fourth grade teacher was a woman by the name of Schwerner. And that name should ring a few bells for some people because she was the mother of Mickey Schwerner, one of the three civil rights workers killed in Mississippi in June of 1964. The civil rights movement was salient to me, as was the Ku Klux Klan. I was involved in civil rights demonstrations in New York protesting discrimination and prejudice. So I was drawn to a study of the Klan. In addition, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1960s was viciously anti-Semitic. However, I chose to study not the Klan of the 1960s, but the Klan of the 1920s in an honors project as a senior at Arizona State University and later for my PhD dissertation at the University of Wisconsin. I was drawn to the Klan of the 1920s because it was the most powerful social movement of the American right wing in our history. It was a national movement, which drew its strongest branches, its strongest claverns in Indianapolis, Indiana, Chicago, Illinois, Denver, Colorado, and Los Angeles, California. This was an organization that was primarily anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish, not anti-black. It is estimated that perhaps 6 million men and women joined the Ku Klux Klan during the 1920s. For my dissertation, which became my first book, I studied Colorado, which elected mayors throughout the state. The Klan elected mayors throughout Colorado, elected a governor, elected the lower house of the state legislature, and elected both United States senators from Colorado. I found membership lists, 20,000 names for Denver and the small towns of Colorado, and I did a statistical analysis. I wanted to know who these people were, their occupations, where they lived, their marital status, the number of children. And what I found in this exploration was that these Kluxers, Klansmen and Klanswomen, were not the fringe, not the poor, not the alienated, but middle-class men and women, 30 years and older, married with children from stable homes. This was not simply an academic interest, a learning experience on a scholarly level, because I learned a lot of things personally as well, things that fortified my identity as a Jew. I had 20,000 names. So the first thing I did is I hit the telephone books. I wanted to know if any of these people were still around because I wanted to interview them. And lo and behold, they were still alive. And I started writing letters. Foolishly, I used my real name. I used my name Goldberg, a Jewish signal. But I thought this was an old movement. Anti-Semitism surely was dying in this country. This was the middle to the end of the 20th century. Well, in the first 30 letters, I received not one response. I then switched tactics, moved my first name to my last name, made my middle name my first name, and magically became Alan Roberts, and sent 30 letters out, and guess what? The boys wanted to talk. Face to face with what I will call the beast. And what these Kluxers told me was upsetting, was painful, but it was also strengthening. As one Kluxer told me, you can tell a Jew just by looking at him. And I said, well, how can you do that? What are their characteristics? And he said, you know, they wave their hands around a lot. Their eyes are shifty. Surely you have Jewish friends, he said. And another Kluxer told me, you can smell a Jew because Jews have Jew stuff which oozes out of their every pores. In 1980, I was offered a position at the University of Utah, and it was my very first time in Utah. And I must tell you, my first look at Utah was rather stunning. It looked like Scandinavia, and it looked like the 1950s. There were glass milk bottles, and everybody seemed pregnant. Dorothy, this sure wasn't New York City. I felt absolutely out of place. Worse than Arizona. My response to that was to start reading first about the Mormon people and then reading about Jews in Utah. I found a book or two about Jews in Utah. Not very good books, but I was particularly struck by a little curiosity, a curiosity I found in a book on ghost towns in Utah. It seems that there was a Jewish agricultural colony that had become a ghost town since, a Jewish agricultural colony in Sand Peak County, Utah. There was a picture in this ghost town book of a gravestone inscribed in Hebrew in the middle of the Utah desert. Clearly, my interest was aroused. I did some research and found one article. In 1911, 200 Jewish families in Philadelphia and New York subscribed money to buy land in Utah to create a back-to-the-soil movement. They named their colony Clarion. This was to be a clarion call to the Jews back in the cities, in New York, in Philadelphia, in Baltimore, and Chicago, to leave the cities and restructure Jewish life. I went over to the state government and looked at the land records and found names of these people who had subscribed money. I put ads in Yiddish newspapers and the New York Review of Books, and also hit the phone books, one of my favorite things to do, to look for the more unusual names, not like Goldberg and not like Goldstein, but Binder, Okun, and Nilva. I was able to track down 53 of the families that were out in Clarion in 1911. And these 53 families produced 9 journals ranging in size from 15 to 200 pages, 6 tapes, and in fact, 1 survivor still around. What I uncovered in Clarion, in Utah, was a moment of Jewish time, a moment of Jewish time informed by a mass of materials. I interviewed the sons and the daughters who had maintained networks one with the other, people who had permitted themselves to go on pilgrimages to Sand Peak County to touch this moment in Jewish time. And they had preserved the letters and they had preserved the notes. Being Jewish allowed me entrance into their lives. Being Jewish allowed me to understand the nuances of their lives. But I was always struck by the fact that when I interviewed these people, they brought the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren to sit around and listen, because this was a story in their minds worth telling. I also interviewed Mormon farmers in San Pete County, and I was impressed. They remembered the colony, and several had painstakingly collected information about the colony, and gave it to me. Take it with you. Write a book about this. This is important. Still, I was jarred, being in San Pete County, when I heard the word Jew as an adjective. those are the Jew farms, and those are Jew fences, and those are Jew gravestones. It conjured up Nazi Germany to me all over again. Clarion in Utah was part of the Back to the Soil movement, which saw 20 agricultural colonies, Jewish agricultural colonies, planted in the United States. Others were planted in Canada, Argentina, and of course, Israel. In fact, in 1909, Degania was the first kibbutz created in Israel, preceding by just 2 years the Jewish settlement in Clarion. The Jews of Clarion stayed on the land for 5 years, struggled against poor soil, no water, weather disasters. Some will stay for 20 years in San Pete County, there because they believed they were changing the lives of a larger population of Jews. That they failed is their history. That they struggled, that they fought, that they were greater than themselves, and they fought for the Jewish people is the legacy they leave to my community. I have great pride in knowing that their story is now being incorporated, at least at the junior high school level, in Utah textbooks. Again, in my research, I was changed. I learned about Russian discrimination. I learned about Jewish radical movements. I learned about the migration. This was, for me, self-education and self-study. And I take pride in the fact I added a piece of the Jewish mosaic. My third book related to my activism in the 1960s, to my activism in the civil rights movement and an organization called Students for a Democratic Society. Social movements, collective action by men and women to change America. Again, I was intrigued by the Jewish angle. Disproportionately, Jews populate social movements. It is estimated that half of the Communist Party of the 1930s and 1940s was Jewish in America. The free speech movement at Berkeley, the Students for a Democratic Society, the National Organization for Women, disproportionately Jewish. And I suggest a Jewish socialization process, family conditioning, community conditioning, which fosters a toleration of radicals, which fosters a questioning of authority, which fosters an assertiveness in defense of rights. Even more personal, in my study of the Communist Party in New York during the 1930s and 40s, I came across the Furriers Union. The Furriers Union was heavily dominated by communists. Well, I remembered when my father came back from World War II that he had briefly been a member of the Furriers Union. I immediately got on the phone. "Hey, Dad, did you ever hear of Max Green?" "Oh, sure, I knew Max Green. He was way back in the Furriers Union." "Did you ever hear of Aaron Silverman?" "I knew Aaron." "Wait a minute," he said. "Who you been talking to? Where'd you get those names?" My father then told me something that he had never told me before. He had been a member as a child of the Young Pioneers, a communist youth group in the 1930s. And it also informed a statement he had made constantly to me during the 1960s. "Whatever you do, whatever protest you're in, whatever organization you join, don't sign anything." My most recent book was a biography of Barry Goldwater, the senator of Arizona for 30 years and a man who ran for the presidency in 1964. A man who is credited with birthing the American conservative movement, the modern American conservative movement. As a youth, I was absolutely intrigued by Barry Goldwater. The first political book I read at age 11 in 1960 was The Conscience of a Conservative. In 1962, at age 13, I read Why Not Victory, Barry Goldwater's other book, and I knew Barry had the answers. In high school in New York, I was the only supporter of Barry Goldwater. Now, Barry and I have split company politically. The Vietnam War drove me to the left while it drove him further to the right, but that's another story. I was eager to do a biography on Barry Goldwater, to revisit the site of my adolescent rebellion, and to study the closest Jew to the office of the American presidency. Two jokes made the rounds of the Jewish community during the 1964 campaign, both in reference to Barry Goldwater's Jewish father and Christian mother. One went, well, we all knew that the first Jewish president would be an Episcopalian. And the second one was one that Barry told. He was preparing to tee up to play golf one day and tee up at a restricted club, a club that didn't admit Jewish members. And the president of the club came running up to him and said, Barry, you're half Jewish, you can't play golf here. To which Barry said, well, since I'm only half Jewish, let me play the first nine holes. In the book, I explore Barry Goldwater's Jewish roots. I trace the story of his grandfather, Michael Goldwasser, from the shtetl in Poland to the Arizona outback and eventually to his home in San Francisco. He was a man who held to his faith, weekly services for the Sabbath, sending his children to Hebrew school, being part of the Jewish merchant network which emanated out of California and which netted Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Idaho. And he was a man who was a Zionist, a believer in the foundation of a state in Israel that was Jewish. His son Baron was bar mitzvah, but lost his way, became alienated, assimilated, did not participate in any Jewish organizations, and married outside the faith. Barry Goldwater's first memories are of Christmas, sitting in the lap of Santa, who, interestingly enough, was played by Aaron Goldberg, another Jew who lost his way. Barry's Judaism was never mentioned by his father, and Barry said to me during one interview, here I am, a half-Jew, and I don't know a goddamn thing about it. But Barry Goldwater found that his Judaism was not so easy to escape. At Virginia's Stanton Military Academy, where Barry Goldwater went to high school, he was nicknamed, according to his yearbook, Goldberg, which surprised me. And I spoke to his roommate, interviewed his roommate, and his roommate said, and I quote him, it was better than calling him Kike. In other words, Barry Goldwater had faced anti-Semitic prejudice at Stanton. I quote Barry, I had to go back east to learn that Jews were somehow different. Rather than sensitizing Barry Goldwater, rather than giving him a greater awareness, he made no protest. He accepted it in silence, and he ran from it. When he attended the University of Arizona and pledged Sigma Chi fraternity, he made no objection when his closest friend, Harry Rosenzweig, a Jew, was denied admission because there was a no-Jews policy in Sigma Chi. As president of the Phoenix Country Club, he maintained a strict, restricted policy. And when Jews in Phoenix were seeking to open the restricted clubs, Barry Goldwater would not assist them. In fact, he held his press conference announcing his concession to Lyndon Johnson after the 1964 election at the most notorious restricted club, the Camelback Inn. Barry Goldwater never came to terms with his heritage. He never accepted it, and he really never understood it. Yet always he had a sense of ambivalence, always a desire for distance, because his Jewishness made him feel different. It made him uncomfortable. And he had a recognition, which I think all Jews in this country have, that we all fear, that we all know, that despite this golden land of freedom and golden land of opportunity, we are a minority. And as a minority, we face hostility. And we are not at ease in this golden land. Jews feel the need, as I would argue any minority in this country does, to accommodate, to adjust, and to assimilate. This makes us more Jewish at home, more Jewish in our community than we are outside. In conclusion, I hope that this roundabout excursion has shed light upon the questions of this session, that is, about history thinking and history writing, and their mesh with ethnic and religious identities. Who I am profoundly shapes what I study, the questions I ask, and they color my interpretation. Still, my interpretations are bound by my personal and professional integrity. I have been privileged. I have never been restricted nor intimidated by community authorities or by a community censor. My hope is that my work is devoid of denial, of excuse, or of mindless glorification. If not, my exploration of the past would short-circuit my larger goals. For to explore the past is to understand myself, my community, and my people. Thank you.
We'd like to open it up for questions. And we can either have you guys come to the front and ask the question in the microphone, or we can pass the microphone around, or you can just shout your question real loud and they will restate it for the benefit of the audio recording. It really doesn't make any difference to me, but I think it would probably be easier if you just say your question loud and let them repeat it. And please direct your question to one of them if it's, you know, categorized that way.
I'll ask the first question then. Dean, I was really impressed by your talk, and I guess I'm struck by the fact that what we read in the newspapers constantly is we have the image reading the newspapers that the Mormon authorities are looking out their windows with telescopes, especially at the University of Utah, and questioning, wondering what's going on up there, especially the work of Mormon academics. Your talk suggests that that doesn't seem to be the case. What do you make of that dichotomy in terms of perception and reality?
Well, you know, I can only speak from my own experience. And as I said, my turn may come tomorrow. But I think that there's probably a perception generally and a misperception generally that on the part of academics that we're much more important than we really are and that people are much more concerned about us than they really are. I think in the sort of broad flow of what is happening within the Mormon faith, I really don't think we academics really have the power to change anything very much. And we kind of live within our own little world. And so it seems to me that it may be a conceit on the part of we academics that people down at South Temple are peering out with their telescopes and looking at us. So that's my answer to the question. I've got a little story to tell before we go to the next questions. Because Bob and I had a great ethnic experience. We were in St. Louis, and we went up on the Arch. Now, I don't know if you've ever been up on the Arch in St. Louis, the Saarinen Arch. It's a wonderful thing. And you sit in these little tiny cells, knee to knee, with two people opposite you as you go up this arch. It's not a thing for claustrophobes. And we were sitting there in this little cell going up the arch, and it's worse than an elevator because you're right face to face with the people opposite. You can't look up at the numbers or anything, and so you have to strike up a conversation, which we did, and we found out that the couple sitting opposite us were from a Bible college in Iowa. And Bob looked at me, and I looked at him, and then we both gagged because we realized their worst fear was now happening. They were caught in this little cell with a Mormon and a Jew. Yes.
I just wonder if you think you'd have the same experience of a hierarchy if you made your living in Utah County.
Well, maybe not me personally, because as I said in my talk, my interests and as an academic usually don't seem to say much, I don't think, to the authority or the integrity of church leadership. I study farm people I studied people in Utah Valley, farm people in Alpine, and said a lot about their lives, and a lot about their lives that isn't consistent with the way we often understand Mormons to be. Talked a little bit about conflict in their lives, how they tried to deal with conflict. So far, nothing's happened as far as any official reaction, even in Utah Valley. In fact, the book was for sale in Utah Valley long before it was for sale, I think, up here in Salt Lake Valley. So I don't know that it'd be that different. For me personally, it might be different for others.
A follow-up to that question. Dean, it's come to my attention that you've been offered positions at Brigham Young University and that you've turned them down. Could you go into that for us for a moment?
Well, Bobby sure knows how to embarrass a friend. I did apply for a position at BYU a few years ago, and was one of two finalists who were about to be invited to be interviewed at BYU. And then as I faced that possibility, sort of eyeball to eyeball, I decided I would rather be teaching at the University of Utah, that there was really more of a mission for me to Latter-day Saint youth at the University of Utah than there was at BYU. And so I chose not to go to BYU. I don't know whether I would have been offered the position, but I immediately stopped my interest in going to BYU at that point. Yeah, Rick?
I did have a question for you, but after Bob's question, I'm directed towards him.
Okay, good.
What if you had the same offer to teach at BYU than you teach at?
God, Rick, I don't know. When I first came here, came to Utah, people said, you're going to live among the Mormons. And I said, the only thing I know about Mormons is like that 1830, 1840 period, and I don't know a whole lot since then, but that was in the graduate books that I had to read for my dissert, for my oral exam. So I knew about that, but I didn't know about 20th century LDS people. But my answer was, I think, a good one at that time. And that was, I live as a minority wherever I go, whether it was in Texas, and I lived in Texas, and in Arizona, Wisconsin, Colorado, or California. And it hasn't been a problem for me living here. And I think that I might find the lifestyle of Utah County somewhat more restrictive. But the people I know in the history department at BYU, I find to be honest and reputable people who would, I think, make good colleagues.
We might just add on that last statement with this question. I'm aware of some relationships between the Mormon communitarianism and the efforts of Jewish leaders to decentralize and to bring Jewish culture back to the soil. Specifically, this some colony here in Utah, but other colonies, Franklin Harris, for example, went overseas on a colonization project.
In Russia.
And I was drafted in myself on my first job in the Department of Agriculture into some of this effort to bring the Mormon idea of local community action into Jewish life, and actually visited a place called Hightstown, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that? Mm-hmm. And there were a number of Mormon personalities involved in that movement, which you may know about.
In my study of, I was very tuned in regard to my study of Clarion to understand the interaction between Jewish farmers in Sanpete County and the larger Mormon population. What I found, and this is from Mormon sources as well as Jewish sources, is a real sense of camaraderie. That here we were, according to the Mormons, here we were common pioneers, brothers and sisters of the soil. And as pioneers, we needed to help one another. And I heard story after story after story from Jews about how Mormons would come and facilitate the creation of Clarion. The LDS Church will actually make a donation to the support of the Jewish colony in Clarion in 1913. The governor of the state plus the agricultural extension people will do everything and anything they can to make the colony a success. A fellow by the name of Ben Brown, who is prominent in the New Jersey colonization, became partners with a group of Mormons in this state to found a variety of companies, who was constantly seeking their advice, whether here or back in New Jersey. And I have also found, in terms of Israeli officials, that there is a real sense of camaraderie between the leaders of Israel and leaders in Utah and Mormon officials.
Drafted in somehow this movement of Ben Brown. Mm-hmm. That's the name I know.
Right.
But it's interesting that I connected in some way with what you've been talking about.
Yeah, way in the back. Is this one for Dean?
This one's for Dean. Dean, I was interested in your comment about your tolerance for dissonance and whether or not you have any speculation about where that comes from and whether or not that is because of the balance of what you feel, the goodness and the positive aspects that you get out of the community in which you live and associate. Does that give you that tolerance?
I don't know. It could be genetic. I was born in the Bighorn Basin, which is in the provinces of Mormonism, and as a child moved to the Boise Valley with my parents, which was also the provinces of Mormonism. I've always been a provincial Mormon, a provincial in Mormonism. And in some ways, like Bob, I guess my Mormonness was always raised by my friends in the Boise Valley. I remember when I was a kid, actually, I had lots of friends, and we did things together when we were in the 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th grades. And by about the 9th and 10th grades, I started being not invited to things that they were having and doing and felt vaguely hurt and rejected, but didn't know exactly why. And it wasn't until much later, I think, I realized that it was my Mormonness that was causing that distance between me and my friends. Now, I don't know how this answers your question, except, and also, I guess, just in my personal life, there's always been a certain amount of dissonance trying to, I guess, mediate between my wish to be liked by my friends in Middleton High School and be a part of their crowd and do things with them, and my realization that my ethnic identity prevented me from being a part of much of what they did and much of what they wanted to do. That has always been a painful part of my existence as a human being and has caused me, I think, to have to deal with dissonance. And so maybe that's the reason why I have that. A tolerance of dissonance.
A little follow-up to that. I guess if I'm hearing you right, I'm hearing this kind of discussion, the sense of dealing with ambiguity or shades of gray, what I would probably say, is a result maybe of a lot of things that you tried to describe, but that may be coming from now. Living with shades of gray versus shades of black and white, they, where you are in your life, I take it that you're comfortable with it, it makes sense, you fit, and so on. What else do you do in your Mormon world? Are you active in the church, and you go out with the guys, and you got black and white and shades of gray guys that you get along and talk? You're an older, mature guy.
So this is true confessions time.
He's asking about your relationship in the Department of History as well.
Well, I guess I have to say that I love the church, and I love my people, and I'm a high councilman in a university stake, and I love the kids that I work with up at the university stake. I think they're some of the finest young people in all the world. And I'm very proud of an institution that produces that kind of quality in young people, and am proud to be a part of such an institution. That's all true. On the other hand, I don't think God really cares a whole lot if somebody accidentally drinks a cup of coffee once in a while or has a beer in Chesterfield. I just think God has a lot more important...
That's pretty specific, Dean.
I think God has a lot more important things to worry about. And so I bracket some of those things. Is that laying me out sufficiently?
Your trouble is you've been tampering with the Sermon on the Mount.
Not too much, I guess. There's another. Yes, is that Carol?
It is.
Hi, Carol. My contacts don't work so well.
Person with ecclesiastical law. It was my impression in the olden days that if a Cullen or a Kaplan converted, they were not ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood in Mormonism, believing that they already had it. Likewise, a Levi or a Levine, they would already have the Aaronic priesthood. Ergo, it was my assumption that Mormons thought they were Jews, or vice versa. Is this, in fact, true?
Well, okay, first, I can't answer your first question. I doubt it. I don't think it is true. Can anyone tell me, anyone
Jan,
here tell me for sure?
That?
Jan?
Well, I think that's probably to do with the second half of the question. I don't know specifically, though. I've seen the same... I've seen the same kind of suggestion that Jews didn't need to be ordained. Because they already had the priesthood.
Well, right, and there are doctrines passages in the Doctrine and Covenant. I'm not a great scriptorian that have that kind of suggestion. But I think in practice, Jews who are converted to Mormonism are ordained to the priesthood in the same way that everybody else is. And I don't recall reading any accounts of them in the past being treated any differently.
So there's no Jewish fast track.
Not that I know of. The reason is because we're all Jews, Bob, and we're all playing on the same field. Armin.
Well, we're just cousins. This kind of question really something probably Steve Epperson did address.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
My reading of his work suggests that, no, there was never a policy of this kind, but there were discussions about it among the earliest church leaders about the extent to which the Jews had a side deal with God in a variety of ways that would not necessitate going through all of the rituals that the rest of the church members would go through. Just how widely this understanding of the exceptionalism for Jews discussed and carried on is not clear from Steve's book, and one of the criticisms is that he was too selective in his sources, but he, the other day here at this symposium, I think, had a good answer to that. Anyway, I think those who are interested in that question really would get the most authoritative answer
sure.
to it from Steve.
Sure, okay. But the second part is much easier. Yeah, but the second part of the question is much easier. Jan and many others have written on, and you're all aware of the identification of the early Latter-day Saints with the House of Israel and the way in which we reified the experience of ancient Israel in our minds by moving out into the desert, by settling along the Jordan River, by a Dead Sea. All of this, I think, tends to give us a Jewish identity. I mean, I think Bob's a great guy, and I love him. But I think we have an affinity more than just his charming and pleasing personality, because I have always felt that he being the token Jew, me being the token Mormon in our faculty, we have something that we share. And that's because, you know, I read my patriarchal blessing, and it says I'm from the house of Ephraim. And I really, that has meaning to me, identifying me with Israel. And so that's all my life. I remember as a little child, the first Jew I ever met, I was so excited. That sounds corny to Bob, but it's true and it's important. I don't think that answered your question, but...
Jews think that Mormons are Jews.
Right. Bob can address that.
This is a very sensitive question, and let me address it this way. I think Mormons are very comfortable with Jews when they think of Jews as biblical Jews or the Jews of Anatevka. But when you face a 20th century American Jew who basically is a Democrat who votes a liberal to a left agenda, there's a little less comfort. So I think the identification for Mormons is, again, more with the Jews of the 19th century and perhaps the Jews of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. I know that American Jews are very sensitive to Mormon opinion. They are very pleased with the amount of support the LDS Church gives to the State of Israel and the importance of the State of Israel to American Jewry. And I think that there is very little that would make very little that would stop a coalition of Jews and Mormons in regard to certain issues, and other issues would never provoke a coalition.
There was a lot of opposition to building the institute.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Real opposition.
But I think that was as not opposition to Mormons as it was to a right. Mm-hmm.
Would you be willing to comment at all beyond what I just read in the Southern California newspapers about the brouhaha of the Mormons baptizing for the dead? A lot of Jewish brethren and sisters.
Well, Jews are real sensitive to that. Because so many of us have seen, have died in the name of our religion. And the decision by Jewish organizations to approach the Mormon Church and say, please stop doing that, and the willingness of the Mormon Church to respond to Jewish needs has been very, very much appreciated. It is an issue that goes to the, it's an issue of emotion. It's an issue of spirit rather than an issue of mind and reason.
And could you, Dean May, talk about how did that happen within the organization before the church had to go apologize?
Now that you're a counselor.
No, I can't. I think it was probably just simply a matter of, I mean, you know how records are entered. There are thousands of workers who volunteer their time to enter records for processing with temple ordinances, and I think that quite thoughtlessly and naively these records were entered without thinking that it might offend the sensibilities of Jewish people. I think Bob's right. I think Mormons are a little bit naive in their sort of sense of Jewishness and don't really have a very deep understanding of Jewish culture and what it is to be Jewish. They don't have very many contact with Jewish people and aren't very sensitized. I have to tell you a story, actually, about Jesse Norman in that context, which is only obliquely related, but it's kind of a funny but a painful story. Jesse Norman, of course, is the great American black singer who was giving a concert in Israel with Zubin Mehta and Robert Shaw. That's how I know this story. Robert Shaw told the story to us last week. And the Israeli audiences are wonderfully appreciative, and they applauded and applauded and applauded, and Zubin Mehta came back and said, Jesse, you've got to go out there and do another number, just anything. Just think of something you can, you know, from your tradition. And she went out and sang, "Were you there when they crucified our Lord?" Now, Mormons are naive. They're not quite that naive, I think.
Are we ready to return?
I think that's it.
James?
Another question for Bob.
Yeah.
I've just kind of noticed, well, definitely within the Mormon tradition, scholars and kind of have a sense of responsibility to kind of influence doctrine to an extent and definitely influence church leaders. And I wonder if there are some similarities in the Jewish experience as far as scholars trying to affect, change doctrine, and influence leaders.
It's a tough question, James. First of all, there's an honor given to scholars in the Jewish tradition. There's even a prayer on Yom Kippur, the holiest of days, which is "Bless the scholars in our midst." Being a scholar is
doesn't happen in Salt Lake, Bob.
There is a respect that is given me as a historian by my community. But I wouldn't deign to make suggestions in regard to ideology or doctrine. I would make a stand in regard to women having equal access to rituals. that women have every right, that gays have every right within my community. But at the same time that I'm saying that, there are biblical scholars who are influential in regard to the forming of opinion and interpretation. And that's the key word here. Rather than doctrine or catechism, what Judaism is like history in my mind, a series of interpretations and possibilities. And scholars are expected to put in their two cents in regard to that.
Two quick ones. I've got a buddy who called me and he says, my youngster's on her way to Jerusalem for the LDS activity there. Would you send her at this time because of the current breakdown?
Well, let me respond to that first. Okay. Because I can't tell anybody what to do, but I will say that there was a comparable situation in the early 90s in regard to the Iraqi war and the use of missiles on Israel. There was another situation in 1973 in the wake of the Yom Kippur War. And the question was, do we send, because people, and I was willing to do this, to volunteer to go to do civilian, non-military things to release other people to go to the front. Do you go? Do you put yourself in harm's way? And I have always believed that you do put yourself in harm's way, because there are some things worth dying for. There are some things worth dying for. And in my mind, the state of Israel, as my country, the United States, are two places worth dying for. And yeah, I would go. And I would not let terrorism win.
Second, a little broader one. What's your thoughts generally about the Mormons having an institute in Jerusalem? And do you have any misgivings about that involvement there?
I have no misgivings one way or the other. My sense is that people... I respect people's right to choose. I really believe that Thomas Jefferson was right when he said, the people will do what is just. I've never worried about versions of the truth. I've never worried about competing ideas. It's just not part of my makeup.
Even though it might be a proselyting activity, pure and simple.
It's never bothered me.
Yep.
And on that note, almost, Rick?
I don't know if his quip was a hypothetical or not, but it's not a proselyting activity. As a recent, not recent, when I went to Jerusalem, I went with BYU and we had a sign, an actual statement that said we do not proselyte under any condition.
Yeah, as I understand the law in Israel, there's proselytizing by any group is prohibited, except by obviously Jewish groups.
And Jewish groups
don't proselytize.
As a matter of fact, though, we don't have that elaborate institution with the infrastructure and the costs involved in other areas of the world. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll go to China and set up an institute. I hope.
Jesus wasn't born in China.
But
that? Jesus wasn't born in China.
That's true.
Jesus wasn't born in China. A lot of Jesus' brothers and sisters lived in China.
That's true, too. Dean, did you want to say anything else?
No.
I'd like to thank you very much and appreciated the questions, and thank you all for coming.